Amen. So we are continuing through our series of the book of Acts, focusing on the gospel of Acts, the speeches and the sermons and the declarations of the gospel throughout the book of Acts, which, like we said a few weeks ago, really makes up about a third of the entire book. Last week, we were in chapter 3, where Peter and John, they heal this man who is lame from birth, and it creates this stir. They proclaim the gospel. They're calling people to repentance. And when we pick up today in chapter 4, we're really, it's an immediate continuation of this same situation, where now the religious leaders pick up on what's going on, and they bring Peter and John in for questioning about this whole situation and the stir that has happened in the temple. So we're going to pick up in chapter 4, starting in verse 1, and are really going to emphasize just this, the first 12 verses here and where this will bring us today. So Acts chapter 4, verse 1, it says, "And as they were speaking to the people, Peter and John, preaching the gospel, the priests and the captain of the temple and the Sadducees came upon them, greatly annoyed that they were teaching the people and proclaiming in Jesus the resurrection from the dead." Again, like we talked about a few weeks ago, that was not a message that they were expecting, not a message that they approved of. Verse 3, "And they arrested them and put them in custody until the next day, for it was already evening. But many of those who had heard the word believed, and the number of the men came to about 5,000. Huge crowd of people that whose lives were changed by the gospel already. Verse 5, "On the next day, their rulers and elders and scribes gathered together in Jerusalem with Annas the high priest and Caiaphas and John and Alexander, all high-ranking Jewish leaders and officials. And when they had set them in the midst of this group, this council, they inquired, 'By what power or by what name did you do this?' Referring to the healing of the lame man. In verse 8, "Then Peter, filled with the Holy Spirit, said to them, 'Rulers of the people and elders, if we are being examined today concerning a good deed done to a crippled man, by what means this man has been healed, let it be known to all of you and to all the people of Israel that by the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whom you crucified, whom God raised from the dead, by him this man is standing before you well. This Jesus is the stone that was rejected by you, the builders, who has become the cornerstone. And there is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved.' Now when they saw the boldness of Peter and John and perceived that they were uneducated and common men, they were astonished. And they recognized that they had been with Jesus." And goes on to talk about how they were, at this point, a little bit too afraid to actually punish them because of the crowds. And everyone approved of what had been going on. And so they held back at this moment. But again, we see this declaration of just the core of this gospel message. Jesus died, and he rose from the dead, and he brings this restoration and this salvation that can only come through Jesus. There is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. The gospel of the whole New Testament is an exclusive gospel. The gospel is an exclusive gospel. And we need to acknowledge, all of us, we know this because we live in the world that we live in, but we have to acknowledge that this idea is offensive to many people. It was offensive to the religious leaders in the first century, and it's offensive to people in our modern culture as well. So we have to be willing, if we believe the gospel, which those of us who are believers, I believe most of us, all of us in this box are, if we believe the gospel, we must be willing and courageous to proclaim the truth of the gospel and the fact that the gospel is exclusive, that salvation is only available through Jesus Christ. But we can learn to affirm that in a way that, especially in our culture, in our day, in our world that we live in, we can learn to affirm that truth in a way that invites dialogue and discussion rather than division and animosity with the people around us. Thinking about Peter, who had this moment in Jerusalem in the earliest days of the church, this is the same person who later, a little bit later in his ministry career, he wrote a letter to believers who had been scattered throughout the Roman Empire because of persecution. And he penned, I don't know if I should use the word pen, because he didn't have a pen. Whatever he used to write, a quill, he quilled these words in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. He said, "Always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet, do it with gentleness and respect." Always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect. And so what we're going to do today is walk through, we've alluded to this a few weeks ago, these cultural stories, these modern day cultural stories that people align their lives with that are in opposition to the gospel story. And there's no better opportunity than today than to really walk through one of these alternative stories that is maybe one of the most prevalent in our world today. And it's the one that says this, and you've probably all heard this, and there's maybe times in our own lives where we've leaned in this direction, depending on your own personal journey of faith. But here's the secular story. And when I use the word secular, all that means is just not religious, not Christian, people who don't affirm the Christian faith it's just a word that refers to anything that's not aligned with a particular religion. And it says this: it's okay to be spiritual and believe what you want, but it's wrong to say your religion is the only true way for others. It's okay for you to believe what you want to believe. That's fine. And you do you, so they will say, right? But it's wrong for you to think, or especially to overtly say, that what you believe is more true than what somebody else believes. This is a very, very prevalent, common, popular, and attractive position held by, of all the various secular stories and viewpoints, this is probably the most prevalent. It's at least in the top two, and we'll keep talking about more in the days ahead, but I'm going to share my screen with you real quick here, because there are two subcategories of this perspective, that it's very important to understand the two aspects here. So let me go ahead. I'm just going to give you a little bit of a visual anchor to... Whoop, I don't want to do that. No. I want to present. And I'm hoping you guys can see this. But within this perspective, we have two people, two groups of people. We have the skeptical naturalist, represented by this thoughtful man on the left side of your screen. And we have the optimistic pluralist, represented on the right side of your screen with the world famous coexist. Typically, we see this on bumper stickers, but I was very, I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but I was surprised that apparently it is very popular to get this tattooed very prominently on large portions of people's bodies all over the world. So there were a lot of pictures to choose from, and I went with this one. And there's many variations of it, but These are the two primary camps within this field. People who say it's okay, believe what you want, but don't come and tell people that your way is the only way. And here's kind of the types of things these people will say. The skeptic, the naturalist, right? The person who says there's the only thing that exists is nature. That's what it means to be a naturalist. The only things that are real are material things. There's no spiritual realm. There's no spiritual truth. There's no true religion. It's just atoms and matter, and that's it. They will say all faiths are expressions of culture. And you basically only believe what you believe because of your cultural context. So if you're a Christian, it's because, well, you were born into a Christian family, or you were born in a Christian culture, and so what other choice did you have, really? Like, that's why you're a Christian, is because your parents were Christians, or you were influenced by Christian people at a young, influential time in your life, and so that's why you are the way you are. And we should forget about all the religious stuff, and we should just all get along for the common good. So these aren't all mean people who just hate everybody. Many of them are very nice, very humanitarian, very philanthropic, and they do want to see good things happen in the world. They want to see people working together and collaborating to make the world a better place. But they just say religion doesn't have to be any part of that equation. This is the skeptical naturalist. And the optimistic pluralist, this person is, from the name, much more optimistic, much more open to the spiritual realms and spiritual teachings, but they'll say, yeah, religion is fine, it's okay, but all religions basically teach the same thing. It's like the spiritual realm and the religious world is one giant mountain, and salvation is at the top of that mountain, or enlightenment, or nirvana. Whatever you want to call it, you can use whatever word you want. And all the different religions of the world are just different paths up that same mountain. They're all leading to the same thing. And everyone can be right. It's okay. So let's find our common ground, find our common truths, and come together around those. And make the world a better place. So, as we go through the rest of this year, kind of keep those two images as we walk through these two different perspectives. And my hope today is that you'll be able to walk away with a sense of, a practical framework to be ready to respond to this type of perspective that people have in a way that aligns with 1 Peter 3:15, doing it with gentleness and respect. So, how do we respond to these viewpoints? And so what I'm going to be sharing with you today is kind of a condensed a condensed flow of thought that's adapted from a book by someone I used to work with at Liberty. It's called Telling a Better Story: How to Talk About God in a Skeptical Age. So it's not a very easy read, but if you're interested and you enjoy that type of reading, you might enjoy reading it. But this will be a condensed version of some of the argument and discussion in that book. So I'm not a genius and just have all of these things floating around in my brain. It's important you know that. But we can learn a lot from other people and who are good at this type of stuff. But what Josh argues in the book, and I agree, is that when we're talking with people, we take an inside-out approach. We're going to talk about this inside-out approach, and it's what we've been talking about since from the beginning of this series. And so I'm going to lay out three steps here, and then we're going to go into a little bit more specifics. The first step is we step into their story. We step into their story and we ask. And again, we've been talking about this for weeks. What is your story? Understand, where are they coming from? What's your story? What brought you to that conclusion? What brought you to that conclusion? And a third question, similar, but maybe a little bit more direct. How do you know that's true? And you may not ask all three of these questions. There may be one that's more appropriate for a given moment or a given conversation or a given person. What's your story? Obviously has more of a tone of looking for life experience. What have you been through? Understanding them as a person. How do you know that's true? Is a little bit more focused on hearing someone's reasons for why they believe what they believe. But the question, what brought you to that conclusion, is kind of a blend of the two. It's kind of looking for, you know, the experience and the life behind the thought process, but also involves those reasons. So those are questions that might be helpful to just write down and have in your own mind as you engage in conversations with people. What's your story? What brought you to that conclusion? How do you know that's true? And as people explain where they're coming from and people share what they believe and why they believe it, it's going to be really important that we, every opportunity we can, affirm the things that they say that are good, and affirm the things that they say that are true, and affirm the things that they say that align with the gospel story. We're going to show how we do that in just a moment. But we step into their story, right? We don't just start by launching a tirade of proofs about all of the reasons why the gospel is true and why they're wrong. You're welcome to do that if that's your conviction, and that's what you want to do, but we're going to suggest this approach. We step into their story. Second thing, we do invite them to consider some of the pitfalls of their story, of their perspective. Show its pitfalls. And then, third, we invite them to consider the gospel story. So we step into their story, we show its pitfalls, and then we invite them to consider the gospel story. Like we talked about a couple weeks ago, no matter what perspective you have, whether it's the Christian story or some alternative, nobody can 100% prove any of these perspectives. Even Christians, we cannot 100% definitively prove with our own eyes, we saw it happen, that Jesus rose from the dead. We just can't do that. And they can't definitively prove their perspective either. So while none of us can definitively 100% prove, there's ultimately a degree of faith behind anything we believe. But what we can do is compare the stories. We can invite people to compare what they're believing with the gospel story and say which story provides better answers to the questions you're asking. Which story makes more sense? Which story is more true to what we see and experience and intuitively know about the world we live in? Which story is more beautiful? Which story better enables us to love others, to live a fulfilled life? Which story provides better hope for the future? And we can invite them to consider the gospel story. But so let's talk about these two perspectives. And we're going to start with that first, that thoughtful man, the skeptic naturalist. So again, this is the person who says all faiths You only believe what you believe because of your cultural context. We should all just get along for the common good. So that first step, we step into their story, assuming we've already had a conversation about, hey, what's your story? What brought you to that conclusion? We've asked those questions. We find agreement. Absolutely. We can acknowledge that to some degree, there's no doubt we are influenced by our culture and our cultural context. There's no doubt about that. And we should certainly, of course, absolutely, I agree, we should all work together for the common good. That is, I'm all for that. Let's do that. But let's talk about this, some of these underlying ideas here. If beliefs are merely the product of culture and my cultural context, you could ask this person, doesn't that mean your own beliefs are merely the product of your cultural context? How can you trust your own position if our beliefs are simply the product of our cultural context? You've turned the question back on your friend, right? In a very kind and gentle way. It's just a simple return of the question, right? If our beliefs are simply the product of our culture, then aren't your beliefs simply the product of your own culture? Because people who don't believe in a God, or atheists, or naturalists, strictly speaking, are very hard to find in traditional religious cultures. So would you be an atheist, or would you have this naturalistic perspective if you were born in a different culture? And we could affirm, yes, our cultural context does condition us in very many ways. Again, there's no doubt about that. But it certainly doesn't determine everything we believe for all of our life. And we could point to many examples. There are many people who are raised in a Christian background who grow up, people make their own decisions, and they walk away from the faith. There are many atheists who grow up never hearing the gospel. They grow up in a naturalistic environment, in an atheistic environment, and they grow up and they embrace the Christian faith. So this idea that we're simply the product of our culture really doesn't stand up to sound reasoning. It's really just a smokescreen of trying to ignore truly thinking about what we believe and why we believe it. And then this question. What do you do if other people have a different vision of common good than you do, based on their own cultural context? You say, let's all work together for the common good, but what do you do when other people disagree about what is the common good? Do you think your view of the common good is superior to theirs? What motivates you to embrace people who are deeply different from you and who don't share your views? So we show the pitfalls in the thinking and the reasoning of this approach. We stepped into their story. We highlighted some legitimate holes in that thinking. And then we can invite them to consider the gospel story and how the gospel compares with their story. The Christian story recognizes that cultural context affects the way people believe and affects people's lives. But Christianity upholds the dignity of every person, and it doesn't reduce people to a mere product of their culture who can't make his or her own decisions. And the gospel teaches that Jesus loved his enemies and died for them. And so because of that, we extend the same love toward those who are deeply different from us, even those who oppose us. And Jesus' resurrection motivates us to live our lives in the present, seeking the good, right? The common good of those around us, in light of the future hope that Jesus is restoring everything to the way it's supposed to be. So we can truly pursue a common good in the present, while at the same time acknowledging that our hope is ultimately not in anything that we can accomplish in this world. So which story is more livable? Which story gives us the resources to actually work alongside and work for the good of people, even people who have a different belief in what common good means, and even people who oppose our own beliefs? It's the gospel story. Now let's talk about the optimist, the optimistic pluralist. This is the person with the coexist tattoo boldly printed on their arm. And actually, I was just thinking, that person's coexist tattoo, Stephen, is a lot bigger than your vessel tattoo. So you might need to, if you really want to compete with, people in the coexist community, you might need to bump up that vessel tattoo up a notch. But anyway, we'll talk about that later. So the optimist, again, this is the person that says, maybe everyone can be right. All religions are basically the same. They're all different paths leading up the same spiritual mountain. And so let's just all find the common ground and work together with that. So again, we've already asked, what's your story? What brought you to those conclusions? And understanding just where they're coming from, stepping into their story, affirming what's good, right? Absolutely, I can see the appeal of that perspective. And I can see how for many people that would be rooted in really a desire to humbly acknowledge our limitations and pursue common good on common ground. That is a noble, good thing to want to do. And we should certainly strive to treat everyone with dignity and respect, even those who have differing beliefs, and say, hey, yeah, where is some common ground and how can we work together to do some good in this world? We need that. But let's talk about this idea of this pluralistic approach that everyone can be right. And the idea that you can't say that your way is more right than others. So by claiming that there are many paths to the same salvation or enlightenment or whatever you want to call it, aren't you, this is, now we're showing pitfalls here, aren't you creating your own teaching about salvation that actually contradicts how most religious people around the world understand their faith? None of the religions of the world teach that they are just one of many paths up the same spiritual mountain. every major religion around the world makes exclusive claims that they have truth with a capital T. So at the end of the day, if you believe pluralism is right, or this perspective is right, then anybody who does not embrace that perspective is either wrong, or they're just ignorant, or they just haven't figured it out yet. But essentially, that's what you would have to conclude. Since none of the religions of the world believe what you're saying, they would all have to abandon many of the distinctive characteristics of their faith in order to embrace this perspective. And so here's the thing. It's okay to believe that your belief is true. And the point is, we all do that. That's not a secret. No matter what you believe that it's true. Otherwise, you would not believe it. We all do that. The problem with this pluralism is that it's presented as a way that's more tolerant and inclusive than other belief systems, while at the same time, you're making your own exclusive claim that requires people all over the world to abandon their own distinctive beliefs. And so we need to be honest about what that's actually saying. How can people be true to their exclusive religious beliefs and embrace this perspective of pluralism at the same time? Because as a Christian, I cannot be a Christian and also believe that there are many other paths to salvation. And someone who is a Buddhist doesn't even believe that there is such a thing as a personal God. And yes, all of the different religions believe in some aspect or concept of love, but how that's defined and how God embodies love is drastically different from one to the other. So they're just not compatible. And then we invite them to consider the gospel. We step into their story, we show its pitfalls, and we invite them to consider the gospel. Christianity, the Christian story, acknowledges that many religions share common beliefs and principles. Absolutely. But we don't ignore the major differences between them. And we don't attempt to reduce all of the religions of the world to the lowest common denominator. Because really, that's kind of insulting to the millions of people around the world who sincerely are living out their belief and their faith. By saying, oh, all of the extra stuff you believe, let's all just do this. The gospel story is exclusive, again, like every major belief system, and even like pluralism, which is exclusive itself. It just says that it's not. The gospel is exclusive. The gospel story says, like we read in Acts this morning, salvation is only possible through the death and resurrection of Jesus. But this salvation is extended and available to all people, to all nations and all cultures and all ethnicities and classes at every level of society. And it's not even debatable that Christianity is the most geographically, culturally, and racially diverse belief system in the entire world throughout human history. It is the only truly worldwide religion that allows for a wide diversity of cultural expression. If we look at the disbursement of the major religions throughout the world and where they exist and where they are observed throughout the world, 90% of Muslims live in a stretch of land from North Africa to the Middle East to Southeast Asia. 90%. 95% of Hindus live in India and its surrounding nations. 90% of Buddhists live in East Asia and worship there. But Christianity, 25% of Christians are in Europe. 25% of Christians are in Central and South America. 22% of Christians are in Africa. 15% of believers are in Asia, and that number is growing faster than anywhere else. And 12% of Christians are in America, the smallest percentage in America. That's a whole nother conversation, because we think that we have all the answers and that we're the best. But Christianity is the most culturally diverse belief system in the entire world. That allows for the greatest amount of cultural diversity and cultural expression. And the Bible itself ends with this vision of God's kingdom restored and people worshiping him from every nation and every tribe and every people and every language. We haven't just become this one uniform people. Like, all of these nations and tribes and languages, they still maintain their cultural distinctiveness while uniting around their common faith and life in God's kingdom. That is the picture of the perfect world in the biblical story, in the gospel story. The very thing that you're saying you're longing for. So we just compare these stories. Which story gives you a better foundation for pursuing the well-being of others, even those with whom you disagree, even those who oppose you? Which story provides a better foundation for unity among people of all cultures, social and economic backgrounds? It's the gospel story. And now, at this point, like we've said before, a person may not be at a point where they're ready to believe the gospel, but they have experienced a conversation with someone who genuinely listened to their perspective and their experiences. They've been challenged to consider the possible weaknesses in their own position and their own thinking, that maybe I haven't thought through this as clearly as I thought I did. They have someone they know they can talk to when they have more questions about the Christian faith. And now here's the thing. If they're smart, which they probably are, it's probably a very smart person that you're talking to, their next question might be this. Well, how do you know that the Christian story is true and everyone else is wrong? Like, wait a second, let me turn this question back on you. And that's exactly what we want them to do. That's the point. Now they're at a point where they want to hear reasons for the gospel. They're literally asking for it. And you have a captive audience. And bring us back to 1 Peter 3:15, this verse that Peter wrote. that he quilled to the believers scattered throughout the ancient world. Always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Anyone who asks you, your greatest opportunity to present someone the truths of the gospel and to lay it before them and invite them to take their next step in following Jesus is when they are at a point through their interaction with you where they are actually asking for it. And walking through this approach of stepping into their story, showing its pitfalls, especially with this perspective of, like we've been walking through, you can't say your religion is the only true way. Well, the gospel is exclusive. Well, how do you know that the Christian story is true? So those reasons, we will wait for another talk, another day. We'll get there. Today's focus was, how do we approach this objection, this issue of the exclusive gospel? It was exclusive from the beginning. It's exclusive today. And I hope that processing all of this today helps you feel equipped to manage these objections.